So just a little bit about who we are now. Dorian Garrett, Daniel Garrett, his son, is a very, very smart young man. And I formed a company to facilitate implementing these technologies. As you know, funding for this kind of R&D work has gone very much from the public sector to relying on you and your REIT associations along with that. And it just made sense for us to privatize this work. We thought it was much more sustainable. The company is Theta Solutions. It consists of the three of us. We have a number of customers throughout the world in both genetic evaluation software and service, and we provide service in genomic data preparation and turnkey parentage and other evaluations related to genomic information. Yeah, I know, I keep hitting them both. All right. How's that? I'll stay with it. Great. So the topics I'm going to cover today, using the genomic data in our models, we call the marker effects models. We want to talk about one of the major changes that go on in this evaluation. The way we do our genetic evaluations substantially affects the accuracy calculation. We want to explain that to you so there's no confusion about this. We have some new improved traits, quite a few new improved traits that go beyond just these two sets of traits, sustained cow fertility and carcass traits. Those are probably the most impacted among the IGS partners traits. But there's a couple others, cavities, and we've just changed the models in general. So, but let's talk in the big picture of why we do this, why we evolve these things. You know, we had a lot of people during our testing and development process over the last bit look at EPDs and say, oh my gosh, why did these change? And we still get that. Warren Hyde is our point person for having to answer the why do my EPDs change questions. Well, first of all, they change because we change things. So why do we change things? Why do we evolve these technologies? You know, and this has been something we've done ever since the advent of not just producing EPDs, but one of the oldest technologies known to man, selection of mates. Why do we change the technology? And there's a fundamental reason here to improve technology. And these improvements will cause change in EPDs, and they should change. In fact, there's no reason to do any of this if things aren't changing, right? And changing for the better. Imani Sachi's gonna follow me talking about this notion of changing, what the changes did and how much better they are. So what drives this evolution? Knowledge of models. Now most of the models, other than these new marker effects models, have been around for a very long time, have been well known. But, you know, there are new methods, there's new computational methods. These marker effects models represent new thinking and how to do things. But those really aren't the drivers of change. Data, no, that's not driving the change. We're collecting data in order to facilitate this one thing we're trying to do with the changes. What am I talking about? Why are we making these changes? Anyone want to wait? Lauren, why are we making these changes? To improve accuracy of the prediction. Exactly right. We make the changes. Every change that we implement should improve the accuracy of the genetic prediction. Accuracy here is part of the driver to improving the rate of genetic progress, whatever that is, whatever you define it as. And there's some enabling technologies involved here, and I'll talk a little bit about that, enabling technologies that allow us to implement these changes. Enabling technologies that we've been talking about here at BIF for the last couple of years that we've leveraged very hard is the advent of low-cost, relatively low-cost, high-performance are called GPUs, and also other components in the computer, in computers and workstations, star computers, that were developed primarily, originally, for the computer gaming industry. And it turns out now, anybody in here, you're probably afraid to do this, anybody in here own any stock in NVIDIA? Anybody do really well in NVIDIA the last year? That's the primary company involved here. And if you anybody watch Cramer on CNBC? Boy, no one makes investments. Yeah, there's one in the back. Yeah, this is, he even named his dog NVIDIA. This company is so good. Well, they're the primary developer of this technology. It was primarily developed for the gaming industry. But scientists have discovered that this stuff really, really helps for high-performance computing. And that's what we really needed in order to implement these more sophisticated techniques that help us make better predictions. So along with that, there's the whole notion of genomic data. And all of you, I'm sure, you know, the Gavset Padlin are in here. You're all collecting tissues, sending it off to your favorite labs or your favorite breed associations in order to identify what we call single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. What those are, this just illustrates, it's the change in a single base pair, and these changes, the idea is we're looking for the changes or the differences between animals at these SNP locations that are associated with some difference in an effect on a trait, whether it's birth weight, growth, having difficulty, what have you. We're looking for these, in the tissue, these single markers associated with an effect on a trait. And that's, at the crux of a marker effects model. There's a lot of neat technology in here, a lot of players involved in here. Several of the companies are here today. The marker model that we use is a little different than the marker model used by other breeds. It's called the single-step super hybrid marker effects model. It includes not just genotyped animals, but non-genotyped animals. And Steve mentioned the numbers. Out of the 17 million, actually about 13 million, a little less than 13 million animals entered the analysis. And as of 2 weeks ago, I didn't count today's analysis, we started to run 2 days ago. I haven't counted this week, so it's probably up by 2,000 genotype individuals. There were 134 of those, 1,000 of those nearly 13 million were genotyped. But we use all the animals, all the data simultaneously, whether they're genotyped or not. And so the genotype record, again, Monty's going to talk about, adds accuracy to the animals who are genotyped and some accuracy to their relatives. And but all the other animals are still predicted in the evaluation. We do multiple traits at the same time, just like we always have done. Multiple components, meaning milk and growth are solved together, total maternal calving ease and calving ease are solved together. We have extra polygenic effects, and I'll explain that a little bit here. The markers don't describe all the genetic differences. But the current markers that we have don't describe all the genetic differences, and I'll explain that a little bit. What we use is a technique that's generally based on the notion of marker selection. So these markers aren't actually sitting, in the vast majority of cases, on the gene itself. They aren't the causative mutation. They aren't the thing that's actually causing the difference between two animals. They're next to the genes in most cases, or in many cases, in the cases of where we use them. They're next to the genes. They're associated to the genetic differences, but they aren't the genetic difference themselves. And the vast majority of markers, when you have a 50K genotype, which is kind of our standard, 50,000 markers, the vast majority of them actually have no effect on traits. And we've known that for quite some time, those of you who have looked at things like Manhattan plots, and a lot of people show those here. They don't have an effect on the traits. Here's an example. So on the horizontal axis here, is birth weight. And on the vertical axis is post weaning gain for a data set that I have. Actually, this shows then for each locus, each marker, what its predicted effect is on birth weight and post weaning gain at the same time. And so you can see there's a whole set of markers that have effects on both traits. There's a whole set of markers here that have an effect on one trait or the other, and those are on the zero axis. And but what's the reality here is this is only 5% of the markers out of the 50,000 that were fit in this marker selection exercise. And if you peel this down even further, if you go down and get more aggressive on saying, well, I'm much more confident that only this set of markers actually have an effect on the trait, you lose, or at least you eliminate from the analysis the need for all these other thousands of markers. The vast majority of markers do not have an effect on the trait. And by implementing marker selection, you can actually improve the accuracy of the prediction if you do it appropriately. Here's another one. This is stability. Along the horizontal axis is chromosome windows. Each color is a change, it's a new chromosome. And the vertical axis then is the effect of this window of markers, how much of the variation they describe. And you can see the vast majority of these marker windows sit along the zero axis at the bottom, not having an effect, and only when a marker actually jumps up or a window jumps up above that line substantially is it actually influencing the trait. So we think it's very important to implement these marker selection and then fit in production only markers that actually we can identify as having an effect. Because fitting all the other markers are noise. Here's another way to look at it. Again, the change in colors on the horizontal axis represent different chromosomes, starting at 1 and moving over to 29. And the vertical axis is the probability of entering the analysis, or the probability of having an effect. And really, only up around the top, where the probabilities are near 1, are those markers ones that we're confident should actually be included in the analysis? Much below that, the markers are noise, and so we eliminate those from the production analysis. And we constantly look at this and check it and make sure we're right. In addition to marker effects and animal effects, we fit all kinds of other things. This is a multi-breed data set, so it's breed year kind of clusters in a technique called Westell additive genetic. Understand that. We fit heterosis, of course, in here. What we do it as these two breed type outcrossing equations, and we can dig into that more if anyone's interested. Obviously, contemporary group, we fit something called a J equation that accounts for genetic error. Genotype animals tend to be different than the genetic error of the non genotype animals, and you have to account for that and include them. A K equation for centering. Okay, so that's kind of the overview of our marker effects model. I see a couple of people yawning, if that's appropriate. All right, but here's one of the big things that we changed to. Independent of the marker effects model, this new compute power, new methods, new techniques allowed us to implement a new way to calculate the pieces of the accuracy calculation that's important. And I think we tend to, in our decision making, forget how important it is to consider accuracy of a decision we're making. And this new accuracy calculation allows us now, this new method allows us to do all kinds of things. You know, we always look at an accuracy number and look at two bowls and say, this one's more accurate than that, or they're about the same. But that's really not usually the important accuracy. Important accuracy is one we don't give you. And that's the difference between two bowls. What's the accuracy of looking at a pair of bowls and saying, are they different, are they not different? Or a cluster of bowls, or an alternative decisions about bowls. Those are the most important accuracies. Now, with these new techniques, they're called sampling techniques, we can provide those kinds of numbers. We aren't doing it yet. I mean, we are doing it, but we aren't providing them. One of the other things that this method does is it's called a direct method to estimate the prediction error variance. That's a component in the accuracy, the key component. It's a direct method as opposed to an approximation method. We've always had to use approximations to do this because this actually turns out to be the most challenging computation. It takes the most time. You know, if we're just producing EPDs, right now our run end-to-end in this evaluation takes about 60 hours for the Herford Association. We do the same kinds of things. That one takes, I think, about 35 hours. But the majority of that, 90% of that time, is spent calculating accuracy, not EPDs. We can calculate EPDs in these things very quickly. So those approximation methods that we used to use, turns out we knew it. They had problems. They had issues. And these issues cause bias in the accuracy. And the bias was virtually always up. In other words, we always overestimated the accuracy in the approximation techniques compared to the direct method. We always overestimated accuracy. So now we're experiencing accuracy drops in the number, but not actual drops in accuracy. Don't be confused. The accuracy is not going down, it's going up. But the number you're going to look at tends to be lower for the same amount of information because we've removed this bias. There's no approximation bias. The bias usually came or was especially pronounced when an EPD was predicted using a lot of correlated trait data. Think carcass traits in particular, because most carcass traits were predicted using just ultrasound or primarily ultrasound data, not just primarily ultrasound data. Now, IGS previously weighed and developed an ad hoc procedure to kind of account for that, so it wasn't too bad, but some other data sets we've looked at, that approximation bias was pretty substantial, pretty significant. This is related to Herford. We already got substantial depth in total herd reporting. We did drop to, in some models, fewer traits, in some models, more traits. So we did some model rearranging to optimize these analyses. But here's a look at what happened. Now, this illustration came from the Herford Association, but it's the same thing in IGS's previous analysis and other analyses where the approximation bias exists. Along the bottom axis is the old accuracy, and this is for a group of sires. So the approximated accuracy. Along the vertical axis is the direct method, so the non-approximation bias accuracy. And you can see the bulls, and each dot represents a different bull, they tended to be overestimated pretty substantially. Can you hear me? They tended to be overestimated in accuracy pretty substantially. And this is for bulls who have progeny. When you go to non-parent young animals, bulls, that was much worse. It was much worse, especially in the carcass traits. So accuracy numbers will tend to look lower, but the accuracies are not lower. These are much more accurate estimates of accuracy. Other big thing, a new way to do cow fertility. IGS has had, or several of the IGS partners have had stability for a long time. We just changed the model, and been around BIF for the last several years. I've given some talks. Scott Spidell's given some excellent talks. We've done a lot of research on a new technique called a random regression technique for improving how we utilize the data for stability predictions. Generally, stability has improved prediction of stability has improved actual in real accuracy because of these new random regression techniques. We're fitting the data in a much more sensible way, and we're fitting also now a marker effects model on stability, which helps to also improve the accuracy. And stability tends to be the driver most maternal index is one of the key drivers. But basically what happens here in the stability as opposed to the old methods, and you're gonna see, for example, in Red Angus, their stability correlations of new stability, old stability tend to be relatively low. In other words, they've changed a lot. But that's mostly not due to the marker effects model, not due to the random regression approach. It just is due to the fact that the random regression allows us to use the data in a much more sensible way. In other words, we've changed the data a lot. Simple things like how an ET donor count enters the model is much more sensible under these new approaches. How contemporary groups are utilized is much more sensible. And under the old threshold model approaches, we could not use data unless there actually was variation within the contemporary group. And that's caused bias in the stability predictions under the threshold model. And now under these, we can use whole contemporary groups where they're all ones or all zeros, all, you know, tabbed or didn't count. And we can use it at all ages, all observations in a repeat measures model, each cabin record. In a much more sensible way. Let's see. So those are kind of the two big highlighted changes I wanted to make you aware of. Again, cabin ease, we've made some changes there. The carcass trait models, carcass traits under IGS used to just be ultrasound with the carcass equivalent. So the ultrasound intermuscular fat with the marble score. And then a separate analysis, ultrasound back fat with carcass back fat. Well, we've combined them now into analyses with carcass weight, ribeye area ultrasound, and basically yearling weight into a muscle analysis, and then another analysis with the fat components all together. And so that actually impacted the correlations, but it improved. Basically, the old analysis really boiled down to, since there was such a difference between the amount of carcass data and ultrasound data, the old EPDs were just an ultrasound EPD, but now they reflect much more information, and which improves the accuracy of them. So you'll see that too. So that's the list of traits that we released in the initial release, which included American Scimitar Association, and also the Shorthorn Associations, the American Shorthorn Associations. The other breeds, I know Red Angus is targeting a release now, they've approved and targeting a release in August. We spoke to Limousine Galby this morning. They like what they're seeing. They're getting things kind of cleaned up, and hopefully they'll release in July or before August. We've got a number of traits, though, that we're still working on under development that we didn't want to wait for until the release. Right now, heifer pregnancy, we're trying to figure out in a multi-breed organization, no two organizations collected the data the same way. Trying to figure out the best way to process all that data together. Dry matter intake, again, we're trying to gather the data from a lot of different sources, working with some partners to try and produce the best dry matter intake EPD for IGS we can. Of course, Hereford released their dry matter intake EPD. And then we're looking at this days or age, and finish as another way to really enhance. You know, the problem with dry matter intake is it's so expensive. A number of people have done some pretty good work on this days to finish kind of idea. We think that could go a long way. You know, there's a lot of carcass data out there. If we can figure out a way to collect that carcass data and keep it associated with sires,
then we could be way ahead of the expanse of what a lot of gunmetal have taken in. Then another one on there, is still the natural crack is this maintenance energy, how maintenance energy. So we've got a lot of work to do still. Questions? We've got better methods, better hardware, and new ideas. So
one of the things that most folks in the audience won't recognize is when you do the accuracy calculation of the old stuff, it was you had to estimate prediction error variance. And the equation is one, there's a part of the function that's one minus prediction error variance. So if you underestimate PEV, you overestimate accuracy. And that was the problem.
That's the mechanics of it. So now we estimate prediction error variance as a posterior of a Gibbs sampler. And it's expectation of that is the true value of the prediction error variance.
Spangler, your second part of the question was the expression of accuracy.
How do we express accuracy? Yeah, I think 0 to 1 probably is about our finest hour, 0 to 1 on the BIS scale. Everyone's used to it. It's a great de facto standard. Everyone has a feel for it. Well, now we're changing that feel. You got to recalibrate. If I were dictator, I would say let's do this graphically, or let's do this in terms of trade units, of confidence intervals, something like that. I think all that needs to be rethought.
Integration of possible change. Perspective to measure risk, right? Reflect risk.
Put it in something, and then and then to go back to where I kind of started this, the accuracy that we get right now is the Bull's deviation from zero, basically. Well, really, we want to know the accuracy between alternative decisions, and that's something we can pull out of this evaluation. The problem is there's so many combinations here. You've got to have some sort of enhanced computer interface that does it. So this wool versus this wool in some selection decision, which one am I more accurate at? And then Dorian, I'm going to kind of let this out of the bag. We learned about a technique. Scott Newman and I went hiking devil's backbone with Dorian yesterday. Is Dorian in here? There is. Yesterday he came up with this classic Dorian thing. We're hiking along and he tosses us out. We really should have this notion of the best one is the one most likely to occur. And he has some great ideas, and so I'm looking forward to next year's BIF when he tells us how we're going to do this. So, but there are a lot of things we can do with accuracy is the point. That's well beyond a 0 to 1 number. And we should be doing it. Because there's risk to these decisions. And accuracy is our only measure.
Any other questions for Bruce? Yes, sir.
So the finish with something new, that's something that would be incorporated in the API. What's the plan for that?
The question was, what if you have a days to finish EPD, what do you do with it? In incorporation into API or TI might be one of those alternatives. And so, Bruce?
Yeah, absolutely, those should be. You know, what we learned from the Herford index, we tooling our indexes, given how they have dry matter intake and female sustained fertility, those are big drivers of those indexes. Those have to be included. And I think days to finish is probably our best bet for getting lots of high quality predictions for what it takes to feed, cost, what it takes in terms of cost to feed animals. That has to be in these instances.
Days to finish is a reasonable proxy for maintenance costs during the finishing period.
I think it's a reasonable and growth costs.
Yeah.
Yeah, maintenance and growth. Cost to feed, basically. Feeding yard.
So we just talked about agriculture. We just talked about. So Bruce, we talked about accuracy. We just talked about indexes. Why don't we have accuracy on indexes?
Exactly. So we got that capability. That's pretty cool. With the sampling based approach, that's one of the things we can do with accuracy now. Is talk about the accuracy of a selection index. You'd be surprised though, you know, we ignore the accuracy of the selection index, but it's entirely a function of the accuracy of the components plus their covariance, their error covariance. And those are not insignificant things. And so we really need those kind of components to do the kinds of things. You know, if we're gonna select on indexes, we need to know what the accuracy of the index is.
What
should we do? Maybe this is just a comment, not a question. Actually, I'm Daniela Lorenco from the University of Georgia. And Angus is using the formula that I developed at UGA to calculate accuracies. And if we look at the formula, I think it's hard to think about overestimation because we use just the diagonal of the genomic relationship matrix. We don't use off-diagonal.
Okay.